We've done that, been there. We've got the Isaac model, done there, been that. Got the free energy, average magnetization, which is the derivative of the free energy with respect to the field H. Depends on K and H, and has the singularity shown in the previous picture. And now we start out with the mean field theory. As you discussed in the tutorial section yesterday, if you have a single spin and a Hamiltonian, which is given by minus KT times sigma times a dimensionless magnetic field H, then the average magnetization turns out to be the hyperbolic tangent of H. We then focus on one spin at the point R, and that spin fields the magnetic field at that point R, and then the sum over nearest neighbors, the spins at the nearest neighboring sites. This is the same thing, except now we've replaced the spin at the nearest neighboring sites by their average value so that we have a new approximation. The approximation is that we will talk about the spin at R by using this formula with this field as our input. This is what we call an effective field, a mean field, an average field, a field of mean force. The approximation we're going to use is that the average magnetization is equal to the hyperbolic tangent of H effective. H effective depends on the average magnetization. And this is then a nonlinear equation for the average magnetization. This magnetization is, if the original magnetic field is independent of R, this magnetization is independent of R. If the magnetic field depends on R, then you get a slightly different equation, but the magnetization depends on R. We're going to look at these equations for a time. This approximation that we're dealing with here is called mean field theory. Has been used by literally hundreds of scientists to discuss literally dozens of different physical systems in one form or another. Now, I'm going to specialize this for the near critical behavior. Let me go back a couple of slides and talk about what happens before the specialization. If I work in this region of the phase diagram, right around here, magnetic field different from zero, relatively low temperatures, that is a relatively large value of the dimensionless coupling K, then there are at least three and maybe more solutions of the equation I wrote down. Of those three solutions, one minimizes the free energy. And in fact, the free energy is something we should want to have a minimum from our study of thermodynamics and of statistical mechanics. So we take that solution, and that solution holds all the way down to this line of zero magnetic field, changing a little bit, but not much. Up at this point, the magnetization is relatively large. Just as in a ferromagnet, you get a relatively large magnetization at every point in space. There are three solutions here also, that is, for negative values of the magnetic field. There is also one of those solutions which minimizes the free energy. It happens to be a different solution from the solution that minimizes the free energy there. So you come in on this solution here, you bounce over to the other solution there, and you have, in the meantime, a discontinuity in the magnetization. That discontinuity is what we call a first-order phase transition. Now, I'm going to do that much more explicitly, but in a different region of the phase diagram. I'm going to be looking right around the critical point, right around this region here, where the magnetization is relatively small and I can expand everything in sight in a power series of the magnetization. I will end up with an equation for the magnetization. That equation will turn out to be third order and of the same structure as the van der Waals equation. We will then analyze it. We haven't analyzed the van der Waals equation and see what it implies. It will give us lots of interesting stuff about the not only the behavior in the critical region, but the behavior in general of the phase transition. So we start out with this pair of equations. This is where we're coming from. It's a good place to take a deep breath and for me to ask you whether you have questions or comments. Okay. Now I'm going to look at the lowest order in this. Lowest order means I'm going to get as close to the critical point as I can and try to analyze it at the behavior as right at the critical point. Right at the critical point, the magnetic field is zero, so I neglect this term. I say H effective is K times the number of nearest neighbors times the average magnetization. And because the average magnetization is small, I can expand the hyperbolic tangent. Hyperbolic tangent expands as hyperbolic tangent of x for small x is approximately equal to x minus, if I remember correctly, x cubed over 3. We're going to take it only to the lowest order. So we're going to say that the hyperbolic tangent of H effective is approximately H effective. And we now have these equations turn into this pair of equations. This pair of equations has the solution KZ equals 1. That says that K has the critical value, which is 1 over Z. This is a critical point. And we now have, as the lowest order solution, we understand what the critical value of K is. We constructed the thing so that the critical point H equals 0. So now we know what's going on at the critical point. We then consider small deviations from criticality. We write KZ is 1 minus T. T is the temperature deviation from criticality. The reason for this minus sign, which I was asked about previously, is we want T to be positive above the critical temperature and T to be negative below the critical temperature. And then this equation expands as, well, we expand the hyperbolic tangent by using this expression. We then notice that the lowest order term is H, is the linear term, times 1 minus T times the average magnetization. The next order term, we're going to throw away H cubed in comparison to H. We're going to set the deviation from criticality equal to 0. The next order term is simply sigma cubed over 3, average value of sigma cubed over 3. This is what I promised you, a cubic equation for the average magnetization. Furthermore, we can see what our lowest order solution does. The lowest order solution cancels this term against the 1, and we're left with T times the average magnetization is the magnetic field minus sigma cubed over 3. This approach that is guessing the size of things, and it is mostly a guess, guessing the size of things and doing an expansion in which you try to be consistent about the size of things is called an asymptotic analysis. It's a method much used in applied mathematics. You now see it in a relatively simple example. We're going to next analyze this equation to describe what happens near the critical point. Comments, questions? This is the sort of result, in fact, that we get from every mean field theory near the critical point. We're going to make a big deal out of that later on. But now, for now, we're going to analyze this equation. Here's the equation again. Let's look at the case zero magnetic field, T greater than zero. This is above the critical point. The equation is sigma times T is minus sigma cubed over 3. There's one and only one real solution to that equation. The average magnetization is equal to zero when the magnetic field is equal to zero. That's the correct solution above the critical point. Above the critical point, we're in the so-called paramagnetic region. In the paramagnetic region, you don't get any magnetization unless you apply a magnetic field. The situation is different for T less than zero. T less than zero and H equals zero, we have a cubic equation and we have three solutions. One solution is average magnetization equals zero. The other two solutions are the average magnetization is plus or minus, minus 3T, T is negative, minus 3T is positive, raised to a power, and that power is 1/2. This says there is a so-called spontaneous magnetization. Well, first of all, this solution should be thrown out. It does not have the lowest free energy. The solution, these solutions have equal free energy if H equals zero. However, if we apply an infinitesimal H, the one solution has a lower free energy than the other. In fact, the solution in which the sign of sigma is the same as the sign of H has the lowest free energy, and that's then the right solution. That's what these sentences say. So at also, if we worked at T equals zero, we would get this term being zero, and we would find the average magnetization is H to the 1 over delta, with delta equal to 3, would be 3H to the 1 over delta, the coefficient with the cube root of 3, which I didn't write down. It would be 3H to the 1 over delta, with delta equal to 3. And because a cube root is ambiguous as to sign, we would, no, that's not correct. This the cube root is not ambiguous as to sign. It has the same sign as the sign of H, that is the average magnetization has the same sign as the sign of the magnetic field. I'm going with the speed of light through the various regions of this, trying to get the qualitative properties of the equation. Next, I will calculate what is called the magnetic susceptibility. A magnetic susceptibility is the derivative of the average magnetization with respect to magnetic field. I'll talk about it for H equals 0 and T greater than 0. If H equals 0 and T is greater than 0, this term is of higher order and we can neglect it. The average this derivative is simply 1 over T. As T goes to TC, as this small t goes to zero, we get a susceptibility which diverges. This same qualitative results hold for all mean field theories near all the critical points of mean field theory. These results are qualitatively correct near most three-dimensional critical points, but they're quantitatively wrong. The fact that they're quantitatively wrong has been known for well over 100 years. Van der Waals, who sort of derived this kind of theory first, knew that the results of Andrews were inconsistent with delta equals 3. Delta was something closer to 4. Inconsistent with beta equals 1/2. Beta was closer to 1/3. That is, the qualitative properties, magnetization going to zero as the temperature goes to the critical value is correct, but the way that happens is with a different power. Similarly, the way the magnetization goes to zero with magnetic field is with a different power. Similarly, this has a different power connected with it. Van der Waals worked in part in the laboratory of Kamerly Onnes. Kamerly Onnes was a no-nonsense experimentalist kind of guy who said all of these delicate things about what happens in the neighborhood of the critical point are sort of irrelevant. Don't ignore them. Don't pay any attention to them. Let's go on and do some real physics. So this is, in fact, what van der Waals did. He worried about it, suffered a little bit, but never took very seriously the fact that there were discrepancies. Another gentleman, whose name I can't pronounce properly, did lots of experiments noting in detail all of these discrepancies between the behavior in the critical region and the result of mean field theory. Onnes simply did not want... I must have done something wrong. Said something wrong. Onnes simply did not want to pay any attention to this. Okay, here's a picture of what goes on in the phase diagram in the well, I'm going to go on no matter what color you want to be. Okay. Thank you. A proper diagnostician. Cable is loose. Hang on. Put it together properly. Thank you. It's always helpful to have someone who has an understanding of nature. Okay, here's a picture that I drew, like the picture I started out with, in which the magnetization goes this way. Magnetization, in fact, is the average value of sigma. It goes between minus 1 and 1. This represents my numerical solution of the mean field theory equations, along with the minimization of the free energy. This axis, then, is the average value of sigma. This axis is Tc divided by T. High temperatures are up, are down here. Low temperatures are here. And that's wrong. Okay, what is wrong here? This is, nope, that's correct. I take it back. Low temperatures are here. And what happens is, in this high temperature region, there is no jump in the magnetization. In this low temperature region, we never enter into this region of the phase diagram. There's a jump in magnetization between here and there. This curve represents the most extreme values of the magnetization at this low temperature region. These are plots of the, these are isotherms, that is, plots of the magnetization as a function of temperature at different temperature, at different magnetic fields. At magnetic field zero, we go along here with zero magnetization, and then we split into two different magnetizations. The system develops a spontaneous H equals zero magnetization, which can either be negative or positive. If H is a little bit negative, that you get a magnetization which is always negative, and a little bit more negative is always a little bit more negative. If H is positive, you get a magnetization which is positive, and if it's a little more positive, you get something which is more positive. The picture is completely symmetrical between top and bottom. I point out someplace here that although I put capital H on the legend here in the talk and everything I do, I use small h for that. This jump in magnetization between there and there is what is called a first order transition. This change in behavior right there is what's called a critical point. I hope this is clear to you, and if it's not clear to you, see if you can ask a question so I can explain it better. Okay. We continue to struggle with mean field theory. Now, you might ask, why do we struggle with mean field theory if it's not exactly correct? Well, it's very rare to have anything that's exactly correct to describe nature. We do with approximations and with things which are partially correct and try to understand what is going on in nature by picking out the correct things from partially incorrect approximations. This is what goes on all the time in physics. If physics, I probably needn't tell you, is a competitive business, and if I can figure out from an incorrect approximation what's really going on in nature, I'm better off than the guy who waits for the exact solution, who then will come up with what's really going on in nature rather later than the one who works out of the approximation. Okay. Next, I calculate the derivative of the magnetization at point R with respect to the magnetic field at point U. This, we have said a whole bunch of times, is a correlation function called G of, if we're translationally invariant system, it's a function of R minus U, and it is the correlation function is formed from the average fluctuation in sigma at point R times the fluctuation in sigma at point U. We have enough stuff to calculate this derivative because we have an equation for sigma at point R in terms of sigma at all the other points and the magnetic field at all the points in space. K here, remember, is 1 minus the small deviation of temperature from criticality divided by Z, and Z is this number of nearest neighbors, that is the number of terms in this sum. I take this equation and differentiate it with respect to the value of magnetic field at point U. Differentiating this thing, I get the derivative of magnetic field at R with respect to U. That is a delta symbol requiring R to be equal to U. When R equals U, that delta symbol is equal to 1. I then differentiate there and there. As I differentiate there, I get a result which is the correlation function between spin at R and spin at U. That's going to be a portion of this term. If I differentiate here, I get a correlation function between the spin at S and the spin at U. In order to progress in my calculation, I want to go ahead and subtract from this the correlation function at R and U. I then take that subtracted result and subtract it from this and end up with a result in which instead of having a K here, I have a T. That is, the equation takes the form, the delta symbol between R and U minus the deviation from criticality times the correlation function at R minus U is the sum over all nearest neighbors. What this R is doing here is completely obscure to me. It snuck in, of course, when the blue stuff came out. This R doesn't belong. Sum over S nearest neighbors to R g of s minus u minus g of r minus u divided by the number of nearest neighbors. It's a hard calculation. However, this is a calculation that we can perform. The calculation as done here is for very small values of the magnetic field, t greater than zero, and we neglected the sigma cubed term in the expansion. We now can solve this equation. We solve it by taking a Fourier transform of everything in sight. Time to take a deep breath, however, and ask whether you all have questions. Okay? We take the Fourier transform of everything in sight. We define the Fourier transform of this correlation function as the sum over all positions of r of e to the minus iq dot r minus u times the correlation function. There it is. We then multiply this equation by e to the minus iq dot r minus u and sum over all r, everything we see. Delta ru gives us 1. This thing gives us t times the correlation function. These things give us respectively a minus 1 times the correlation function and a cosine of q in the direction j summed over all the different directions times the correlation function. The equation ends up being 0 on the left-hand side is equal to 1 plus square brackets times the correlation function Fourier transform, and the square brackets are minus the deviation of temperature from the critical value times the sum over all directions, I is 1 through D, of cosine lattice constant times wave vector times minus 1. Something exciting is going on here. We could see it. We will see it in a moment in slightly more detail. But as t goes to 0 and q goes to 0, both of these terms go to 0. Therefore, as that happens, for small deviations from criticality and for slow spatial variations, the correlation function Fourier transform diverges. This divergence is the fundamental source of all of the excitement that occurs in the neighborhood of a critical point. This divergence is the statement that near the critical point, you have an unusual susceptibility, unusual responsiveness to changes in the magnetic field. They produce a huge response in the average magnetization, and that huge response produces the singularity that drives the phase transition. This is the conclusion that you would draw from mean field theory. It is also a correct conclusion. Mean field theory gets lots of stuff right. So we look for small q. We see that this is minus t, that this thing is q squared over z, and that we have a lattice constant here. We end up with a result that the Fourier transform of the correlation function is 1 over t plus a q squared over z. So we started out from g of r minus u, converted it into the Fourier transform, which we then solved for, and now we can invert the Fourier transform. We had capital G of q is 1 over a squared plus t, t being the temperature deviation from criticality, and this result applying for t greater than 0 and h equals 0. Notice, incidentally, that we're doing something rather sophisticated. I said that h equals 0. Yes, h equals 0. But the first thing I do is differentiate sigma at r with respect to magnetic field at u. And then I set h equals 0 after the derivative is calculated. This is then what g of r minus u is. Okay. I'm going to do the correlation function, and then I'm going to talk some about history. I can invert this result. I can find g of r minus s. That's the integral over all wave vectors of 1 over 2 pi to the d times the exponential of I q dot r. Dot r minus u times g of q. I can do that integral nicely in 3 dimensions, not so nicely in 2 dimensions or 4. And the 3-dimensional result is that g of the difference is equal to e to the minus the difference divided by c. I have to tell you what c is, and then divided by r. C is given by the lattice constant, that is the separation between the nearest neighbors, times z, that's the number of nearest neighbors, times t, the deviation from criticality to the 1/2 power. This correlation length diverges as the temperature goes to the critical temperature. And that is the major thing which forces this result to be interesting and the behavior in the critical region to be interesting. Now, in one version of this talk, I had a bit of history here, and I think I should do the history again, even though I don't have it written down. Einstein and other people were very interested in the beginning years of the 20th century for understanding what was going on with atomic theory. In fact, they wanted to know whether atomic theory was right. One way of that we already talked about of seeing whether atomic theory was right was to calculate the effect of the motion of molecules on a Brownian particle. Another way of thinking about it was to talk about what is called a critical opalescence. I'm a little confused at the moment, and I don't know whether I talk about critical opalescence later on in the talk as it's prepared here. Let me find out whether I do. Hang on 1 second. No critical opalescence. Okay, I'll talk about it. I can do an ad lib. B, 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 B. There. You take a pot of fluid and you look at it, and it transmits light nicely. However, if you take that same pot of fluid and move it close to the critical point, it tends to look milky. You have what is called critical opalescence. I won't write that on the blackboard because my spelling of opalescence is unreliable. But it is the same word that goes with the gemstone opals and indicates a clouding of the material. This critical opalescence is produced precisely because in the fluid one gets drops. If the fluid is liquid, you get drops of gas, and these drops of gas occur at all sizes and reflect the light. In fact, inside the drops of glass of gas, you also get drops of liquid, which occur at all sizes and reflect the light, until you get a soupy mess which reflects the light. A Polish physicist by the name of Smoluchowski, and later on Einstein, in the years 1908 and 11, if I'm not mistaken, analyzed this critical opalescence and decided that the result was because the susceptibility, in this case, the derivative of the density, which describes the order parameter of the fluid, with respect to the pressure, which is very much analogous to the derivative of the magnetization with respect to magnetic field. They decided that it was because this went to infinity at the critical point, and that would produce an infinite amount of scattering. That's the correct answer. This going to infinity at the critical point is also true, as we have just seen, for the magnetic susceptibility, and in both cases indicates that the material is very susceptible to the effect of small changes. Einstein, in particular, then analyzed this infinity and used it as an argument for the existence of molecules, the existence of molecules within the fluid. Einstein, in that period, was mostly working as a statistical mechanic and was, in fact, working to get as many demonstrations as he could find of the existence of molecules and as many demonstrations as he could find which would give the number, what is called Avogadro's number, which is the number of molecules in a specified volume of a gas, or specified mass of a gas, liquid, specified mass. Later on, not much later on, but a little later on, a German physicist and a Dutch physicist with names Ornstein and Zernike, respectively, analyzed the behavior of the infinity doing the calculation that was described, that I just described here. They did the calculation not in the magnetic language that I described it here, but instead in the liquid gas phase transition language. But since both van der Waals and the magnetic thing have cubic equations, the calculation is essentially identical. Ornstein and Zernike concluded that there was a correlation function of this form. In fact, this is called the Ornstein-Zernike form of the correlation function. This result is not entirely correct. There should be a closed bracket there, but otherwise this is the result of Ornstein and Zernike. And the important thing that you get is that the correlation length diverges as you approach criticality. That is, as you get closer and closer to criticality, you get larger and larger bubbles, until right at the critical point, the bubbles, with bubbles inside them, but the biggest bubbles can be infinitely, essentially as large as you want, limited only by the size of the box. That means that the susceptibility, magnetic susceptibility, which is the integral over of this thing over all R, diverges. In fact, the integral of this expression over all R has one factor of 1 over R from there, but because it's a three-dimensional integral, it gets factors of 1 over C squared, 1 over this distance, proportional to this distance squared, and that those factors then give us an infinite susceptibility in the neighborhood of the critical point. At fixed separation, the correlation function does not diverge as criticality approaches. It is that you get larger and larger contributions on larger and larger scales as criticality is approached. That's the physics of the behavior near the critical point. You get bubbles of this kind, and those bubbles become infinitely large as you get towards criticality. Yes.
Does one get an analogy for this operations at any phase transition or
any phase transition? Remember what I said. I'm going to directly address your question. Remember, I said that for a phase transition to occur, we need an infinitely large system. Well, this is why we get bubbles that are as large as you want, except they're limited by the size of the system. To get a real singularity, infinity, you need an infinitely large system. Consequently, the argument of Ornstein and Zernike about the behavior of the correlation function is quite crucial to understanding what goes on in the neighborhood of the critical point. Now, to make another point, which I've been trying to make through this set of lectures, what we do in condensed matter physics is very closely related with what is done in particle physics. Function of this kind in particle physics is called a Schwinger function. It represents the correlation between a psi at one point and a psi adjoint at another point in a three- or four-dimensional space. The first talking, or one of the first talkings about the behavior of Schwinger functions was by a Japanese physicist by the name of Yukawa in the 1930s. He gave a form something like this and gave an expression for the correlation length in terms of the mass of the particle involved. Because there were particles of relatively small mass available at the time, there was pi meson and the mu meson, both of which have small masses on the scale of the proton, neutron, or other particles in the world. Yukawa was suggesting that there were relatively long-range forces. Small mass gives large C, gives long-range forces, and he was then suggesting that it was long-range forces that held atomic nuclei together. This Yukawa distance, this is the Yukawa distance in particle physics, this Yukawa distance has been an important aid to our understanding since the 1930s. But I'm in the process of developing conclusions from mean field theory. That's what this lecture is about now. And I want one more conclusion from mean field theory. I want to go after the energy, which is the expectation value of H, when we have zero magnetic field and no variation in space. It is easy. What you do in mean field theory is replace the fluctuating quantities, sigma R and sigma S, by their averages. That's what you do. So the average magnetic field, the average energy divided by kT is going to be k times the number of nearest neighbors. Times the number of lattice sites times the product of magnetization squared. I left out a factor of the number of different nearest neighbor products. the number of different nearest neighbor products are in fact the number of different lattice sites times the dimensionality of the system divided by 2. Let me, I'm disturbed enough about that that I will put in the right answer and escape. Let me perfect my thing and then I'll come back to you. Sorry to be so anal compulsive, but I do want to get this, I do like to get things right and hate getting them wrong. So there's the number of particles in the system times the dimensionality divided by 2. Now I am, for the moment, in this line perfect, and I can return to your question. I did not understand the words you said. Say them again more slowly.
So presumably crystal opalescence doesn't occur in a continuous phase transition. There's no discontinuities.
There, presumably something or other doesn't happen in a continuous phase transition. Now fill in something or other.
All right.
Critical opalescence.
Yeah.
Oh, critical opalescence. No, it's exactly in. Thank you. It is exactly in the neighborhood of the critical point that you get the critical opalescence.
Okay.
And then if you're going across a first order phase transition, you get stuff like this, but you get a cost in free energy of when you make these guys. That cost in free energy is proportional to the area of the surface of the drops. That cost and free energy comes with the name of surface tension. As criticality is approached, the surface tension goes as the absolute value of T in three-dimensional systems to the 2/3 power. So as you're going to the critical point, the surface tension gets smaller and smaller, and you can get bigger and bigger drops. If you get away from the critical point, the drops are sort of limited in size because of the fact that you're never going to get stuff coming out which costs you more than free energy than a few times kT. So the rule is critical opalescence occurs near critical points. You can see it in almost all critical points. I should say that we don't, in the conventional low-temperature superconductors, we don't observe critical opalescence, in part because they have a special behavior, which is that they have a correlation length, which is produced by the soup. Because they have a very small energy for the transition, basically. With the exception of superconductors, low-temperature superconductors, every other phase transition that has a critical point has critical opalescence of one kind or another. Yes? That is, critical point means second order. Second order... I should, in fact, tell you what second order means because it's a slightly out-of-date phraseology. Ehrenfest defined first order, second order, third order phase transitions depending on which derivative of the free energy jumped discontinuously. An nth order phase transition has the nth derivative of the free energy jumping discontinuously in the Ehrenfest classification. However, okay, that's directly relevant for this slide, but I'll say it differently. In mean field theory, the second order, the second derivative of the free energy with respect to temperature jumps discontinuously at the phase transition. However, in the honest-to-goodness world, there's no such jump. The second derivative either goes to infinity or is continuous, but in the real world, there is no such jump. So that Ehrenfest's definition of a second-order phase transition is now not often used, not never used. You used it, you used it correctly, but it is not often used because, in fact, we do not see what Ehrenfest wanted us to see when he used the word second-order phase transition. Your question, however, was about whether critical opalescence occurs with particular kinds of phase transitions. Let me answer the question this way. Near critical points, one sees a very obvious behavior of critical opalescence. You see a fluid becoming milky. You see the behavior of a ferromagnet slows down so the things change relatively slowly in it. That's an analogous effect. One sees near a critical point of any one of those systems a behavior which is like critical opalescence. Now, first-order phase transitions have a tiny hint of this sort of behavior left. They have what is called an essential singularity in the derivatives with respect to the analog of magnetic fields. However, it is such a tiny hint that it has never been observed theoretically, experimentally. It is only known theoretically. So yes, a first-order phase transition has some analog of critical opalescence. It has some funny behavior of in a thermodynamic derivative. No, we cannot see it. Yes.
So you can get a critical point between liquid and gas in water, yes. Say, but you can't get one between ice and water.
Correct.
So is there some kind of conditions that can tell you whether you'll get a critical point somewhere on your boundary?
According to the Landau theory, which I'm going to be presenting in 15 or 20 lecture minutes, which probably means on Monday, according to the Landau theory of phase transitions, if there is a change in symmetry as you go from one system to another, you tend to get a first-order phase transition. A crystal then has a symmetry of the direction of its crystal axes, whereas a fluid has no such thing. So there's an essential change in symmetry. The liquid to solid transition is believed to be always first order. Other phase transitions become second order because the amount of ordering in the system goes continuously to zero. The amount of magnetization in the ferromagnet goes continuously to zero. So that you can have a second-order phase transition. Now I'm using the phraseology that I said was incorrect. You can have a continuous phase transition when in a ferromagnet. But it is believed that you cannot have it in a liquid gas system. I say that, but people have argued about it for quite a number of years. Brian Josephson, a Nobelist and a very, very, very bright physicist, argued that you could indeed get a second-order, a continuous phase transition
going from solid to liquid. His arguments were not fully believed by anyone, except maybe himself. On the other hand, what Brian believes or believed has to be taken seriously by everyone. Yes.
You said that the discontinuous phase transition, like the critical opalescence, was very hard to notice experimentally.
It's easy to. I didn't understand everything in your question, but I'll answer. It's easy to observe experimentally. The first time you take a fluid and get it close to the critical point, you see it.
Yeah, but you said that
in a superconductor, you don't see it. You have to get very, very close to the superconducting phase.
Second order phase transition.
You have to get very close in the superconductor, but with any other phase transition, we can see effects of critical slowing down, of behavior in the transport properties, which are special near the phase transition, near the critical point. Okay, I'm now about to talk, despite what I said, about a second-order phase transition, because mean field theory has a second-order phase transition. When you calculate, now correctly in mean field theory, the value of minus the average Hamiltonian divided by KT, you get the, not quite right, this number's nearest neighbors is repeated. You get the coupling constant times the number of lattice sites times the dimensionality divided by 2 times the product of the magnetizations. The only thing that matters here is this product of magnetizations. As you recall, the product of magnetizations is equal to 0 for T greater than 0 and 0 magnetic field, and goes as Tc minus T minus capital Tc, critical temperature, minus the honest temperature for T less than 0. So the derivative of this thing with respect to temperature has a term in it, which is 0 for T greater than 0 and not 0 for T less than 0. What you see if you plot out the derivative of the energy with respect to temperature is that for temperatures below the critical temperature, you have a value of the, and close to the critical temperature, you have one value of the, what is called the specific heat. As the system goes through the critical temperature, the specific heat abruptly goes down, and then there's this discontinuity. This is what is called a second order phase transition. As you will see from pictures that I will present later on, what tends to happen is that you tend to get an infinity around this point and not this discontinuous behavior. I've just described in abbreviated form mean field theory, particularly as it is applied near critical points. If you put aside the specialization for behavior near critical points, a tremendous amount of work has been done using mean field theory. Literally hundreds of scientists and dozens of different systems. For each one of a huge variety of phase transitions, scientists have discovered the appropriate order parameters and constructed theories describe the discontinuities in these parameters that we characterize as phase transitions. This work has been very important and enlightening. It has led us to a working understanding of many of the different phases of matter, and from an engineering point of view, it has told us a lot about the uses to which these phases might be put. Mean field theory is not precisely accurate, but it does give a good working understanding of the many different kinds of phase transitions and the many different phases of matter. The high point of all of this work, in my view, was a 1957 calculation of Bardeen, Cooper, and Schrieffer, in which they produced a theory of superconductivity. As you recall, I think I said it, but as you may not recall, superconductivity was discovered probably by Kamily Onis's lab assistant in 1911. Kamily Onis took credit for that discovery. Superconductivity was discovered in 1911. And in the years between 1911 and 1957, superconductivity remained a mystery. In the year 1957, these guys put together a microscopic mean field theory which enabled us to understand superconductivity. In parallel, two Soviet physicists, Landau and Ginzburg, put together a different theory in which they describe different aspects of superconductivity. The two kinds of calculations together gave us a full understanding of the kind of superconductivity which was known then, which is superconductivity that appears at low temperatures. I'm going to be talking about superfluidity and superconductivity for a little bit, and then let's see, we go to, yes, I'm going to be talking about superconductivity and superfluidity for a little bit. It was, as I told you, another physicist who had been born in Russia, Kapitsa, actually discovered what is called superfluidity in helium in the year 1937. I looked that up. I had remembered it correctly, but not fully. Kapitsa was working with two other physicists, John Allen and Don Meissner. Meissner was also credited with having discovered what is called the Meissner effect, which is that magnetic fields are eliminated from the interior of fully superconducting materials. I'm now copied this, what you see in front of you, from Wikipedia. And it says that superfluidity is a phase of matter in which the viscosity of the fluid vanishes while the heat capacity becomes infinite. Well, that's interesting. Both statements are wrong. That is, there are two statements in the first sentence, and they're not entirely right. So let me tell you what happens correctly. I mostly find Wikipedia to be reliable, but not this time. Temperature. Critical temperature for superfluidity, 2.2 or 2.3 degrees Kelvin. I've forgotten what. Heat capacity, that is the second derivative of the free energy with respect to temperature, has in it what is called a lambda. It goes up to infinity, comes down from infinity, and looks rather like that. So at the critical temperature, yes, indeed, it has a large increase. As a matter of fact, it is believed today that this is not quite at infinity. It's someplace up about there in the picture. The top of this is rounded, and that you get some rounding, but there is a singularity at TC, and the singularity is the heat capacity. Okay, viscosity of a fluid vanishes. That statement is also somewhat incorrect. There is a two-fluid model, a model of understanding the flow in superfluids, in which in one sense the viscosity vanishes, and in another sense, it doesn't vanish at all. Let me see if I can remember how to phrase that. Let me show you. This shows you how one can see a particularly non-viscous flow. This is a picture copied from Wikipedia. The picture is not wrong. Pictures tell lies more seldom than encyclopedias. Not never. The internet is filled with lying pictures, but more seldom. Here is a cup filled with superfluid helium. What you are supposed to notice in this picture is this puddle and this drop. The cup, as the Bible says, runneth over. What happens is that at the edge, here's the fluid, on the interior of a cup, a little film, a skinny film of helium, runs up the cup and starts to run down on the outside, produces a drop, and the drops come off periodically to produce that puddle. Because in some sense the viscosity of the superfluid is zero, it can form this kind of film running up the side of the cup. This is described as film flow. However, one can also see effects of viscosity in this material. One actually has what is called the phenomenology of the material is described in part by what is called the two-fluid model, which more or less says that superfluid helium has a part, that is the excitations, the quasi-particles, which behave like a viscous fluid, and has another part which is quantum mechanical in nature and described by a wave function. And that part which is quantum mechanical in nature and described by a wave function The part which is described by a wave function undergoes superfluid flow, doesn't look like it has a viscosity at all, and does very strange things like this film flow. Now, you remember that we derived from the Boltzmann equation statement about what were the hydrodynamic equations. That is a statement of what happened at low frequencies and long wavelengths. This derivation was based on the understanding of what the conserved quantities were, what quantities had a total amount which did not change in the course of time, what quantities had to flow to change their densities, had to flow slowly from place to place. In our usual fluid, there are five such conserved quantities: energy, number of particles of a given kind, and three components of momentum. But a superfluid is different. It has, in effect, more conserved quantities. It is described by a wave function, and that wave function has a phase, and the phase of the wave function produces a superfluid velocity. That phase of the wave function changes slowly in space and time and serves as another conserved quantity. The point I want to make for you is that the conservation laws are different, effectively, in different materials. And so is the hydrodynamics different in different materials. For example, to use the most familiar example, a liquid has a I have a slide. Yes. You use the most familiar equation. A liquid has a viscous flow in which the velocity in the liquid obeys a kind of diffusion equation, which is driven by the pressure. That is different from what goes on in a solid. In a solid, there are three different components of a sound velocity. There are three different kinds of sound that you can have at long wavelengths. Correspondingly, in a liquid, there is one kind of sound and two kinds of viscous flow. The hydrodynamic modes vary from one material to another. And in fact, civilization has made much use of that variation in the hydrodynamic modes from one material to another. Superconductors are superconductors because they have conductivity which continues essentially forever. Currents tend not to stop if they can go around and around in a superconductor. That's an additional conservation that is in addition to the conservation of momentum that occurs in a solid, and is reflected by velocities of sound and of particle number and of energy. In order to understand what hydrodynamic equations you have, you must understand what the material is really like, and different materials are qualitatively different from one another. I'm going to continue to talk about this with a little bit more about superconductors and superflows next time. I think it's probably right to break now. Questions or comments?
Okay, let's have lunch.
So the tutorial table probably starts well.